Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Lester Brown with Earth Policy Institute conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Jennifer Mullen. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Jennifer Mullen with the Glover Park Group. I wanted to thank you all for joining us on the call this morning. I will turn the call over to Lester Brown shortly, but wanted to let you all know that a copy of Lester's remarks and the corresponding data sets that he will talk about today are already posted on the Earth Policy Institute website. The web address for that website is www.earth-policy.org. We will also be live tweeting today's teleconference from the EPI, the Earth Policy Institute Twitter handle, with the hashtag EPITELCON. It's EPITELCON. And lastly, a recording of today's call will also be available on the same website, the EPI website, later today, so you can go back and listen to today's call if you miss anything. And now I'll turn over the call to Lester Brown, who is an author and current president of the Earth Policy Institute. His latest book, World on the Edge, provides a roadmap for how to prevent an environmental and economic collapse. And that book is also available on the EPI website. Again, it's earth-policy.org. Now I'll turn the call over to Lester.
Thank you, Jen. In thinking about the trend that we're looking at this morning, this reversal in carbon emissions, I've tried to think of a word to describe it, and historic is the only one that I can think of. After decades, generations actually, of rising carbon emissions, suddenly we're headed down, and it's not just a short-term blip. Between 2007 and 2011, U.S. coal use dropped by 10%. Oil use went down by 11%. Natural gas is up by 6%. The net effect of these trends is that U.S. carbon emissions have dropped 7% in the last 4 years. We are using data for 2011 that are based on, that are actually Department of Energy estimates. They used the actual data for the first 8 months of this year and then made estimates for the four concluding months to come up with the estimates for 2011. It's been widely assumed that the decline in carbon emissions is the result of the economic downturn. And that was initially the case, but now there are new forces at work that are driving this decline in carbon emissions, forces that are surprisingly strong and that will be continuing for some time. With coal, we have a strong, well-organized anti-coal movement that's beginning to measurably reduce coal use in this country. In the early stages, it's centered on opposing new coal plants. And as a result of that, there are now very few plants under construction in this country. We have, in effect, a de facto moratorium on launching new coal plants. The Beyond Coal campaign, as it's called, is coordinated at the national level by the Sierra Club, but it involves a couple of dozen national environmental and health groups along with hundreds of local groups. It's a well-organized, very strong campaign. The second phase of the campaign is to close existing coal plants. Of the 492 coal plants we have in the United States, 68 are now scheduled to close within the next few years. One of the closings is the Potomac River coal plant, which is just across the river, literally from Washington, D.C. It is scheduled to close by next October 1st. It's a 62-year-old plant. It's a 485-megawatt plant, which means it's a large coal plant. And it burns 280,000 tons of coal every year. So as a source of air pollution, it's a major one, but it will soon be gone, and we'll have some of the cleanest air in D.C. that we've had in generations. The goal of the Beyond Coal movement is to eventually close all the country's coal plants. And there are a number of reasons for that, environmental as well as health. Most people are not aware of it, but the burning coal leads to 13,200 deaths each year. That 13,200 deaths exceeds all the U.S. combat fatalities in Afghanistan and Iran over the last 10 years. So it's not inconsequential. And the health care costs of treating respiratory illnesses is huge. In August, the American Economic Review published the most comprehensive analysis yet of the indirect effects of burning coal in the United States. And their conclusion was a surprising one and a strong one. It basically writes the epitaph for the coal industry. It said that the damage, mostly from air pollution from burning coal, exceeds the value of the electricity produced at coal-fired power plants. So this is not the cost of production. This is the indirect cost, the effect of air pollution on people, crops, etc. So it's a major factor in the indirect costs are a major factor in the future. This is one of the reasons why New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg donated $50 million to the Sierra Club for their Beyond Coal campaign to further expand it and strengthen it. Michael Bloomberg says very simply, coal has to go. And he's not talking about closing a few plants. He's talking about closing all the coal plants in the country. This sounds difficult, but it may not be nearly as difficult as it first appears. The Department of Energy projections for residential electricity use per person for this decade indicate roughly a 5% decline. And that's a reversal of the historical trend where electricity use per person has been climbing for decades. One of the big factors that is going to reduce electricity use in the years immediately ahead is the requirement from the Energy Act of 2007 that we phase out incandescent light bulbs and replace them with compact fluorescents and LEDs. There are in this country something like 4 billion light sockets, and 3 billion of them still include the old, inefficient incandescents. On January 1st, 2 months from now, the 100-watt incandescent bulbs will disappear from shelves. On January 1st, 2014, 2 years from this January, all the 75-watt, 60-watt, and 40-watt incandescent bulbs will also disappear from shelves. They will be replaced by compact fluorescents and LEDs, which have the effect of increasing energy efficiency by about 80% over incandescents. In some situations, some distributors like IKEA, for example, have already taken incandescents off their shelves. California is a year ahead of Washington on this in banning the use of incandescents. We're also looking at some very substantial gains in household appliance efficiency. And this is because of legislation that's been passed in years past that's now translating into much more efficient dishwashers, air conditioners, TV sets, etc. So we're looking at a situation where residential electricity use is more likely going to be declining than rising, and certainly in per capita terms it will be going down. The other thing that's making it easy to close coal-fired power plants is the shift to renewables, to wind, solar, and geothermal. Over the last 4 years, some 400 wind farms have come online in the United States. They total 27,000 megawatts of generating capacity. That's enough to satisfy the needs of 8 million homes or about 14 million people. But beyond the 27,000 megawatts that have come online, there are now nearly 300,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity in queue waiting access to transmission lines. So we have an enormous amount of wind, not only wind energy, but projects to tap wind resources to back out fossil fuels. The leader in wind electric generation is Texas, which is ironic because it's also still our leader in oil production. The other four states after Texas in wind electric generation are Iowa, California, Minnesota, and Illinois. In terms of the share of electricity coming from wind, Iowa is now the leader with 20% of the electricity consumed in the state coming from wind farms. Solar panels, though starting later than wind, are now beginning to expand very rapidly. At the beginning of this year, we had something like 2,500 megawatts of solar panels in operation. But this year we'll be adding nearly 2,000 megawatts, almost doubling what we've done in years past. Beyond this, there are now 22,000 megawatts of utility-scale solar developments in the pipeline. And these include installations that will generate 200, 300, 500 megawatts of electricity, most of them being built in California, Arizona, and Nevada. But we're looking at huge solar farm installations generating some of the largest ones. There may be one now coming with 1,000 megawatts. At peak power, it would generate as much electricity as a nuclear power plant. While coal use has been dropping, so has the use of oil. And there are a number of reasons for this. One, the national automobile fleet is no longer expanding. In fact, it's shrinking a bit. The fuel efficiency of cars is rising, and the miles driven per car is declining. These are three of the key trends that are leading to the decline in oil use. The number of licensed vehicles in the U.S. peaked a couple of years ago at 250 million. And since then, the number of cars scrapped has equaled or exceeded the number of new cars sold. So the fleet is beginning to shrink, and the peak at 250 million came just 2 or 3 years ago. There are a number of reasons for why new car sales have dropped off and are not expected to regain the levels of that we saw in the late 1990s and the early years of this century. One is a changing attitude of young people toward automobiles. It's an attitude very different than that of earlier generations. In my generation, growing up in a rural community in southern New Jersey, getting a driver's license and a car or a pickup or something to drive was sort of a rite of passage. Every one of my classmates did exactly that. But today, young people growing up in cities, in an urban environment, and where socialization is not taking place with cars but with smartphones, and this is altering it's reducing the number of teenagers who get driver's license, for example. Today we have about 10 million licensed teenage drivers. In 1979, over 30 years ago, we had 12 million licensed teenage drivers. So we're looking at a changing automobile market with young people not being nearly as automobile-oriented. as earlier generations. The second thing is the enormous increase in fuel efficiency. The current standards that have been developed this year by the Obama administration call for an increase in fuel efficiency by 2025 that would reduce by half the amount of gasoline used by cars sold in 2010, which was last year. So over the next 15 years, basically, we're looking at the fuel efficiency of new cars dropping the fuel efficiency increasing by half. People are also driving less, and that's partly because public transport has increased, because gasoline prices have been much higher in recent years, and because cities are concentrating, many of them, on developing a bicycle infrastructure with designated lanes for bicycles, bike paths, parking, sidewalk parking racks, etc. Beyond creating the bicycle infrastructure, some cities are now turning to bike sharing programs, and these include Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York, and a number of other cities. Another interesting demographic that is affecting gasoline use is the number of people entering the retirement age. Once people retire, they're no longer working and no longer commuting, their gasoline use drops by a third to a half. And what we are now looking at is a record number of people retiring. These are the baby boomers who were born beginning in 1945. A 1945 baby boomer is now 66 years old and has retired. So we're just beginning to see the effects of the largest age groups in U.S. history entering the retirement age and substantially reducing their, and as a result, substantially reducing their gasoline consumption. There's also another interesting linkage between coal use and oil use. As coal use declines, so does the use of oil. Coal is moved from the mines to the power plants by freight rail. Roughly 40% of the diesel fuel used in the U.S. freight rail system is used to move coal. So as we move less and less coal from mines to power plants, the diesel fuel use in the freight sector declines. So declining coal use in this case leads to declining oil use. Another thing that's going to affect during this decade, the amount of oil use, the amount of gasoline consumption, is the shift from gasoline to electricity. And that is just beginning. But during this decade, it's going to become a much more important force in reducing gasoline use. This year, we have seen the release of GM's Volt and Nissan's Leaf. The Volt is not classified as a hybrid, but it has both a gasoline engine and an electric motor, runs primarily on the electric motor, using the smaller gasoline engine to recharge the battery when needed. The Leaf, the car produced by Nissan, is an all-electric car. So we're now seeing the first of the all-electric or electric hybrids coming on the market. Prius will be coming on with a plug-in version in early next year. There are literally dozens of either all-electric or plug-in hybrid model cars being developed by all the major automobile manufacturers, and these will be coming on the market more and more with each year. The exciting thing is the prospect of being able to run our cars not only on electricity, but in many cases with wind-generated electricity. So the fuel for running our cars will be a carbon-free source. Michael McElroy, Professor Michael McElroy at Harvard, has calculated the wind electricity equivalent of a gallon of gasoline, and it costs about 80 cents. So there's going to be a strong economic attraction to shifting from gasoline to electricity, particularly if oil prices continue at a high level in the future or rise even higher. So what we're looking at is a very substantial decline in oil use in the years ahead. And that's in addition to the 11% decline we've seen in the last 4 years. One of the consequences of this substantial decline in gasoline use is to question whether we need the much debated Keystone Pipeline to bring oil from tar sands in Canada to oil refineries in Texas. With our gasoline use dropping as much as it is, and indeed already has, there's a question of whether we need that pipeline. Most of the debate on the pipeline as to whether it should be built has been centered around the possibility of leakage of oil, particularly in the states that rely on the Ogallala Aquifer for water and possible contamination of the aquifer. And the second is the climate effect of in effect, creating a much larger market for the energy inefficient oil that comes from the tar sands. It takes a lot of energy to get the oil out of the tar sands, so it's a high-carbon operation. But the question now is, do we actually need that pipeline? I think the answer is clearly no. In looking ahead, we're seeing, in addition to the 7% drop in carbon emissions over the last 4 years, we think that 7% could increase to 20% by 2020. That is, between 2007, when oil consumption peaked in the U.S., and 2020, we could see a 20% drop in oil use and carbon emissions from oil use. It could go even higher. I mean, conceivably, it could go as high as 30%. But the exciting thing is that carbon emissions, which were rising in the United States, the world's largest economy, are now declining and declining at a rapid unanticipated rate, I should say. This means that the U.S. could, if this trend continues as we expect it to, could become something of a model for other countries. And it also means that the United States could again emerge as a leader in the effort to stabilize the Earth's climate. So this trend reversal, replacing the rise in carbon emissions with a decline in carbon emissions, is historic in an economic sense, because it's going to lead to a transformation of particularly the U.S. energy economy, but it also is going to lower carbon emissions in the world's largest economy, which makes it much easier to think about stabilizing climate at the global level. I think, Jen, with that, we can turn to questions.
Great. Cynthia, can you take questions now, please?
Absolutely. Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is off so that your signal will reach our equipment. Again, please press star 1 at this time to ask for a question, and we'll pause for one moment. And we will take our first question from Michael Grunwald with Time.
Hey, Lester. Thanks for doing this.
Hi, Michael.
How's it going?
I
was curious. You mentioned the Obama administration's fuel efficiency rules, and I'm curious how much you think some of the other things that Obama has done, particularly in the Recovery Act, in terms of promoting some of, you know, wind and solar and electric cars. I'm wondering how much you think that has to do with the changing numbers and the changing outlook.
Well, certainly the support for the development of wind and solar has been a major factor in their growth, and this is true of most new industries. They always benefit from public support. The with electric cars, I think what the Obama administration has done is create an environment in which we think about electric cars, and it certainly has been supportive of developing a U.S. battery industry, because with electric cars or plug-in hybrids, the battery becomes an important part of the car. And so I think quite a few of the things that the administration has done, from fuel efficiency standards to supporting the development of clean energy sources, have all contributed to this. But at the same time, we have to recognize that, particularly with coal, that it's been the beyond coal movement which has emerged as such a powerful movement with, as I mentioned, Sierra Club coordinating, but there are a couple of dozen national groups here, including Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, and in the health field, the American Lung Association. So it's become a rather powerful coalition, and it helps explain why they've been so successful in one, stopping new coal plants, and two, starting to close existing ones.
Is there anything further, Mr. Grunwald?
Well, actually, if I could, I was wondering if you had thoughts about, you know, the sort of future of government, the sort of industrial policy, after what happened with Solyndra. I mean, how important is that kind of thing going to be, and do you sort of worry that government support is going to dry up?
There will always be Solyndras when you're supporting new initiatives in any field. But when you look at some of the major technologies that are now in use, whether it's jet aircraft or the Internet, these were all technologies first developed by government. The jet engines, of course, part of the military R&D in World War II. And then the Internet was initially developed to facilitate communication between U.S. groups of U.S. scientists, and then sort of went from there. So government does play an important role, and there's always a question of, you know, how much and so forth. And as has been noted in the press, you know, picking winners is not a certain thing, and so there's always a risk that there's going to be a Solyndra along the way. But the bottom line is that government involvement in R&D and initial support of new technologies has always been an important part of the U.S. development process, and has been a major factor in making the U.S. The economy that it is today.
Thanks.
And moving on to Felix von Geyer with Platts Emissions Daily.
Hello, Lester. Nice to hear you again. Lester, I'm kind of interested. I just want to quickly pick up on a point that Michael made earlier about Solyndra. I think it's probably worth pointing out that there's been an awful lot of lobbying, including paying into Hillary Clinton's former presidential nomination campaign by the people behind the Keystone XL pipeline. that it's worth keeping an eye out on that when people are demonizing Solyndra and the industrial policy of the Obama administration. But the question I want to ask is, if we're looking to actually phase out more of the coal power fire stations, how are we going to do that with very sort of extensive lobbying by people like Peabod Energy, and we've got a lot of the Blue Dog Democrat senators are from coal-fired states as well. How viable is it going to be, and what do we also do if we're going to fuel switch to, say, gas-fired power stations to actually have kind of carbon capture storage on those so we don't actually still have a greenhouse gas emissions problem?
One of the problems the coal industry have, and it's a pretty fundamental one, is that the American people do not like coal. In a poll that was done a few years ago, 3% of Americans, when asked where they would like their electricity to come from and given the options, 3% chose coal. You can't get much lower than that. And the public image of the coal industry and the accident in West Virginia and the image that the coal industry leadership presents in the public is not a very positive one, and people are not very supportive of the industry at all, which is why we're seeing this grassroots campaign that Sierra is coordinating acquire so much firepower, if you will. They're really moving. On the carbon capture and sequestration, most of the research projects on that have been dropped or delayed or what have you. There's very little money now going into coal capture and sequestration, carbon capture and sequestration, which was mostly for coal. I think it was something that was kept alive in order to try to make a credible case that coal was an important part of our future. But despite all the clean coal ads, the industry is not gaining much support, and it is sufficiently isolated that I don't think lobbyists in Washington can breathe life back into the industry. And we do know that even if we had a successful carbon capture and sequestration, it would increase the cost of coal-fired power by roughly a third. And the same would be true for I don't know the economics for carbon sequestration with natural gas, but it would mean a substantial additional cost to the cost of gas-fired electricity at a time when it's having trouble competing with wind, for example. A recent example of this is in Brazil, where they auction off electrical generating rights each year. It used to be that natural gas dominated that bidding process, but the last time around, wind took over almost entirely in terms, I think they're adding another 6,000 megawatts, and two-thirds or four-fifths of them was won by wind bidders. So wind is becoming competitive. So too is solar. So we're in a situation where the cost of renewables has been coming down, is continuing to come down, whereas the cost of fossil fuels is tending to rise.
Is there actually any issue still going to be with the baseload argument? Because obviously having the wind means that a lot of people will say, well, it's great to have it, but you can't rely on it as baseload.
Well, what we're seeing around the world is that's not nearly as much of a problem as one might expect initially. There are three states in northern Germany that now get between 40% and 60% of their electricity from wind. So they obviously have figured something out. In Iowa, as I mentioned, they're getting 20% of their electricity from wind. But there are a number of ways of dealing with that. One, there is a model that's been developed at, by a team at Stanford University looking at wind and baseload. And what they conclude is that if we develop a national grid, which we are in the process of doing, then wind actually becomes part of the baseload because even though wind is intermittent, it's always blowing in many places. So the key is a larger grid and more wind farms. And the more you get, the more stable it becomes as a source. So there are a number of ways of dealing with that. And you're probably aware of the effort that's underway now in New Mexico, near Clovis, New Mexico, which is where the three U.S. grids come together or come very close to each other, one being the eastern grid, which is east coast to the Rocky Mountains, and there's the western grid and the Texas grid. And the what they're doing now is they'll probably break ground on this either next month or in January, but it's well along. And they're going to connect the three grids with about 120 miles of HVDC, high voltage direct current cable, so we can begin moving electricity around. Now, this doesn't really give us a strong national grid by any means, but it is the first step in creating a national grid.
Thank you.
And our next question will come from Isaac Hernandez with El Mundo.
Hello, Lester. Thank you very much.
Hi, Isaac.
I actually am curious about two different things, and you can answer either one of them. One is, do you see the trend in natural gas also going down in the near future and the reduction of fracking? And the other one is, how does our oil consumption and coal consumption, has it gone down when we consider also our imports? Do you know what the trends in China are as far as coal and oil going down, and if our imports, if it's actually more drastic because it seems that maybe we are consuming less imports?
Right.
Thank you.
When you look at carbon emissions in the United States and in China, what you see are two very different trends. For some time, they were both going up, though China was going up faster. China is continuing to go up fast, whereas the United States is now declining at a pretty good rate. The decline in the U.S. in carbon emissions in the last 4 years does not quite offset the increase in carbon emissions in China. But once it becomes known that the U.S. is cutting carbon emissions and that the dip we've seen in the last few years is not just because of the economic recession, then I think it's going to affect how other countries think, and it also is going to give hope that we can actually have a meaningful international response to the threat of climate change. The other thing that I didn't mention is that with it seems like almost every week now there's a new study out talking about how climate change is leading to more extreme weather events, and these are beginning to be of concern to people. And the more concerned we become about our climate future, the more pressure there will be to move from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy. The good news in China is that they have become the world leader in developing both wind resources and in manufacturing solar cells. In wind resources, there are now 7 wind-based complexes under development in China of at least 10,000 megawatts each. To put that in perspective, there is no coal-generating complex or nuclear-generating complex in the world that comes even close to 10,000 megawatts. So these are huge. The largest of these is a wind complex being developed in Gansu province in the northwest. When it's completed, it will have 38,000 megawatts of generating capacity. That is huge. That one wind complex will produce enough electricity to satisfy the needs of a country like Poland or Egypt, for example. And these are two countries for which I've actually done the calculation. So we're seeing thinking in wind energy on a scale that we've never seen in the energy sector before. We've not seen anything on this scale with either coal or nuclear power. So these are the exciting things happening in the world that lead me to think that, that we do have a chance at the global level of beginning to reduce carbon emissions in the years ahead. On the natural gas, down or up, natural gas use over the last 4 years is, 4 years has increased by 6%, as I mentioned. DOE sees very little increase in natural gas use in the United States this year. And whether we'll get a lot of more growth in the years immediately ahead or not remains to be seen. But natural gas has to be able to compete with wind and solar, and with solar, its peak power, which is important, and it turns out that with solar cells, the peak generation coincides very nicely in a place like California with peak power, which is determined mostly by the need for air conditioning. So solar is very good for meeting peak power needs, and it's difficult for other sources to compete with it in that area. The future of fracking is hard to say, but opposition to it is developing in more and more places. In the United States, some states like New Jersey have banned it entirely. Some countries, France, for example, have banned fracking entirely. So we'll have to see how it plays out. But the other thing is that the early estimates of the amount of natural gas that the industry was claiming were clearly fraudulent. They were trying to sell a bill of goods and build a natural gas infrastructure and so forth. But the U.S. Geological Survey, in its estimate that came out, I think it's a couple months ago now, indicates that the amount of gas available, gas reserves in the U.S., including importantly those from fracking, are probably about one-fourth of what the industry is claiming. So those are all things affecting the future prospects of natural gas.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And once again, if you'd like to ask a question today, that's star one at this time. Again, star one to ask a question. Next, we'll move on to Randy Shostak with EOS Newspaper of the American Geophysical Union.
Thank you. Yeah, it's EOS. Can you provide me with some evidence that the decline in the use of coal is linked directly to the Beyond Coal campaign rather than due to economic downturn?
The early decline in coal consumption that began following the downturn in 2007 was almost certainly due to the economic downturn. That was true of energy.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Lester Brown with Earth Policy Institute conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Jennifer Mullen. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Jennifer Mullen with the Glover Park Group. I wanted to thank you all for joining us on the call this morning. I will turn the call over to Lester Brown shortly, but wanted to let you all know that a copy of Lester's remarks and the corresponding data sets that he will talk about today are already posted on the Earth Policy Institute website. The web address for that website is www.earth-policy.org. We will also be live tweeting today's teleconference from the EPI, the Earth Policy Institute Twitter handle, with the hashtag EPITELCON. It's EPITELCON. And lastly, a recording of today's call will also be available on the same website, the EPI website, later today, so you can go back and listen to today's call if you miss anything. And now I'll turn over the call to Lester Brown, who is an author and current president of the Earth Policy Institute. His latest book, World on the Edge, provides a roadmap for how to prevent an environmental and economic collapse. And that book is also available on the EPI website. Again, it's earth-policy.org. Now I'll turn the call over to Lester.
Thank you, Jen. In thinking about the trend that we're looking at this morning, this reversal in carbon emissions, I've tried to think of a word to describe it, and historic is the only one that I can think of. After decades, generations actually, of rising carbon emissions, suddenly we're headed down, and it's not just a short-term blip. Between 2007 and 2011, U.S. coal use dropped by 10%. Oil use went down by 11%. Natural gas is up by 6%. The net effect of these trends is that U.S. carbon emissions have dropped 7% in the last 4 years. We are using data for 2011 that are based on, that are actually Department of Energy estimates. They used the actual data for the first 8 months of this year and then made estimates for the four concluding months to come up with the estimates for 2011. It's been widely assumed that the decline in carbon emissions is the result of the economic downturn. And that was initially the case, but now there are new forces at work that are driving this decline in carbon emissions, forces that are surprisingly strong and that will be continuing for some time. With coal, we have a strong, well-organized anti-coal movement that's beginning to measurably reduce coal use in this country. In the early stages, it's centered on opposing new coal plants. And as a result of that, there are now very few plants under construction in this country. We have, in effect, a de facto moratorium on launching new coal plants. The Beyond Coal campaign, as it's called, is coordinated at the national level by the Sierra Club, but it involves a couple of dozen national environmental and health groups along with hundreds of local groups. It's a well-organized, very strong campaign. The second phase of the campaign is to close existing coal plants. Of the 492 coal plants we have in the United States, 68 are now scheduled to close within the next few years. One of the closings is the Potomac River coal plant, which is just across the river, literally from Washington, D.C. It is scheduled to close by next October 1st. It's a 62-year-old plant. It's a 485-megawatt plant, which means it's a large coal plant. And it burns 280,000 tons of coal every year. So as a source of air pollution, it's a major one, but it will soon be gone, and we'll have some of the cleanest air in D.C. that we've had in generations. The goal of the Beyond Coal movement is to eventually close all the country's coal plants. And there are a number of reasons for that, environmental as well as health. Most people are not aware of it, but the burning coal leads to 13,200 deaths each year. That 13,200 deaths exceeds all the U.S. combat fatalities in Afghanistan and Iran over the last 10 years. So it's not inconsequential, and the health care costs of treating respiratory illnesses is huge. In August, the American Economic Review published the most comprehensive analysis yet of the indirect effects of burning coal in the United States. And their conclusion was a surprising one and a strong one. It basically writes the epitaph for the coal industry. It said that the damage, mostly from air pollution from burning coal, exceeds the value of the electricity produced at coal-fired power plants. So this is not the cost of production. This is the indirect cost, the effect of air pollution on people, crops, etc. So it's a major factor in the the indirect costs are a major factor in the future. This is one of the reasons why New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg donated $50 million to the Sierra Club for their Beyond Coal campaign to further expand it and strengthen it. Michael Bloomberg says, very simply, coal has to go. And he's not talking about closing a few plants. He's talking about closing all the coal plants in the country. This sounds difficult, but may not be nearly as difficult as it first appears. The Department of Energy projections for residential electricity use per person for this decade indicate roughly a 5% decline. And that's a reversal of the historical trend where electricity use per person has been climbing for decades. One of the big factors that is going to reduce electricity use in the years immediately ahead is the requirement from the Energy Act of 2007 that we phase out incandescent light bulbs and replace them with compact fluorescents and LEDs. There are in this country something like 4 billion light sockets, and 3 billion of them still include the old, inefficient incandescents. On January 1st, 2 months from now, the 100-watt incandescent bulbs will disappear from shelves. On January 1st, 2014, 2 years from this January, all the 75-watt, 60-watt, and 40-watt incandescent bulbs will also disappear from shelves. They will be replaced by compact fluorescents and LEDs, which have the effect of increasing energy efficiency by about 80% over incandescents. In some situations, some distributors like IKEA, for example, have already taken incandescents off their shelves. California is a year ahead of Washington on this in banning the use of incandescents. We're also looking at some very substantial gains in household appliance efficiency. And this is because of legislation that's been passed in years past that's now translating into much more efficient dishwashers, air conditioners, TV sets, etc. So we're looking at a situation where residential electricity use is more likely going to be declining than rising, and certainly in per capita terms it will be going down. The other thing that's making it easy to close coal-fired power plants is the shift to renewables, to wind and solar and geothermal. Over the last 4 years, some 400 wind farms have come online in the United States. They total 27,000 megawatts of generating capacity. That's enough to satisfy the needs of 8 million homes or about 14 million people. But beyond the 27,000 megawatts that have come online, there are now nearly 300,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity in queue waiting access to transmission lines. So we have an enormous amount of wind, not only wind energy, but projects to tap wind resources to back out fossil fuels. The leader in wind electric generation is Texas, which is ironic because it's also still our leader in oil production. The other four states after Texas in wind electric generation are Iowa, California, Minnesota, and Illinois. In terms of the share of electricity coming from wind, Iowa is now the leader with 20% of the electricity consumed in the state coming from wind farms. Solar panels, though starting later than wind, are now beginning to expand very rapidly. At the beginning of this year, we had something like 2,500 megawatts of solar panels in operation. but this year we'll be adding nearly 2,000 megawatts, almost doubling what we've done in years past. Beyond this, there are now 22,000 megawatts of utility-scale solar developments in the pipeline. And these include installations that will generate 200, 300, 500 megawatts of electricity, most of them being built in California, Arizona, and Nevada. But we're looking at huge solar farm installations generating some of the largest ones. There may be one now coming with 1,000 megawatts. At peak power, it would generate as much electricity as a nuclear power plant. While coal use has been dropping, so has the use of oil. And there are a number of reasons for this. One, the national automobile fleet is no longer expanding. In fact, it's shrinking a bit. The fuel efficiency of cars is rising, and the miles driven per car is declining. These are three of the key trends that are leading to the decline in oil use. The number of licensed vehicles in the U.S. peaked a couple of years ago at 250 million. And since then, the number of cars scrapped has equaled or exceeded the number of new cars sold. So the fleet is beginning to shrink, and the peak at 250 million came just 2 or 3 years ago. There are a number of reasons for why new car sales have dropped off and are not expected to regain the levels of that we saw in the late 1990s and the early years of this century. One is a changing attitude of young people toward automobiles. It's an attitude very different than that of earlier generations. In my generation, growing up in a rural community in southern New Jersey, getting a driver's license and a car or a pickup or something to drive was sort of a rite of passage. Every one of my classmates did exactly that. But today, young people growing up in cities, in an urban environment, and where socialization is not taking place with cars but with smartphones, and this is altering it's reducing the number of teenagers who get driver's license, for example. Today we have about 10 million licensed teenage drivers. In 1979, over 30 years ago, we had 12 million licensed teenage drivers. So we're looking at a changing automobile market with young people not being nearly as automobile-oriented as earlier generations. The second thing is the enormous increase in fuel efficiency. The current standards that have been developed this year by the Obama administration call for an increase in fuel efficiency by 2025 that would reduce by half the amount of gasoline used by cars sold in 2010, which was last year. So over the next 15 years, basically, we're looking at the fuel efficiency of new cars dropping the fuel efficiency increasing by half. People are also driving less, and that's partly because public transport has increased, because gasoline prices have been much higher in recent years, and because cities are concentrating, many of them, on developing a bicycle infrastructure with designated lanes for bicycles, bike paths, parking, sidewalk parking racks, etc. Beyond creating the bicycle infrastructure, some cities are now turning to bike-sharing programs. And these include Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York, and a number of other cities. Another interesting demographic that is affecting gasoline use is the number of people entering the retirement age. Once people retire, they're no longer working and no longer commuting, their gasoline use drops by a third to a half. And what we are now looking at is a record number of people retiring. These are the baby boomers who were born beginning in 1945. A 1945 baby boomer is now 66 years old and has retired. So we're just beginning to see the effects of the largest age groups in U.S. history entering the retirement age and substantially reducing their, and as a result, substantially reducing their gasoline consumption. There's also another interesting linkage between coal use and oil use. As coal use declines, so does the use of oil. Coal is moved from the mines to the power plants by freight rail. Roughly 40% of the diesel fuel used in the U.S. freight rail system is used to move coal. So as we move less and less coal from mines to power plants, the diesel fuel use in the freight sector declines. So declining coal use in this case leads to declining oil use. Another thing that's going to affect during this decade, the amount of oil use, the amount of gasoline consumption, is the shift from gasoline to electricity. And that is just beginning, but during this decade, it's going to become a much more important force in reducing gasoline use. This year, we have seen the release of GM's Volt and Nissan's Leaf. The Volt is not classified as a hybrid, but it has both a gasoline engine and an electric motor, runs primarily on the electric motor, using the smaller gasoline engine to recharge the battery when needed. The Leaf, the car produced by Nissan, is an all-electric car. So we're now seeing the first of the all-electric or electric hybrids coming on the market. Prius will be coming on with a plug-in version in early next year. There are literally dozens of either all-electric or plug-in hybrid model cars being developed by all the major automobile manufacturers, and these will be coming on the market more and more with each year. The exciting thing is the prospect of being able to run our cars not only on electricity, but in many cases with wind-generated electricity. So the fuel for running our cars will be a carbon-free source. Michael McElroy, Professor Michael McElroy at Harvard, has calculated the wind electricity equivalent of a gallon of gasoline, and it costs about 80 cents. So there's going to be a strong economic attraction to shifting from gasoline to electricity, particularly if oil prices continue at a high level in the future or rise even higher. So what we're looking at is a very substantial decline in oil use in the years ahead, and that's in addition to the 11% decline we've seen in the last 4 years. One of the consequences of this substantial decline in gasoline use is to question whether we need the much-debated Keystone Pipeline to bring oil from tar sands in Canada to oil refineries in Texas. With our gasoline use dropping as much as it is, and indeed already has, there's a question of whether we need that pipeline. Most of the debate on the pipeline as to whether it should be built has been centered around the possibility of leakage of oil, particularly in the states that rely on the Ogallala Aquifer for water and possible contamination of the aquifer. And the second is the climate effect of in effect, creating a much larger market for the energy inefficient oil that comes from the tar sands. It takes a lot of energy to get the oil out of the tar sands, so it's a high carbon operation. But the question now is, do we actually need that pipeline? I think the answer is clearly no. In looking ahead, we're seeing, in addition to the 7% drop in carbon emissions over the last 4 years, we think that 7% could increase to 20% by 2020. That is, between 2007, when oil consumption peaked in the U.S., and 2020, we could see a 20% drop in oil use and carbon emissions from oil use. It could go even higher. I mean, conceivably, it could go as high as 30%. But the exciting thing is that carbon emissions, which were rising in the United States, the world's largest economy, are now declining and declining at a rapid unanticipated rate, I should say. This means that the U.S. could, if this trend continues as we expect it to, could become something of a model for other countries. And it also means that the United States could again emerge as a leader in the effort to stabilize the Earth's climate. So this trend reversal, replacing the rise in carbon emissions with a decline in carbon emissions, is historic in an economic sense, because it's going to lead to a transformation of particularly the U.S. energy economy, but it also is going to lower carbon emissions in the world's largest economy, which makes it much easier to think about stabilizing climate at the global level. I think, Jen, with that, we can turn to questions.
Great. Cynthia, can you take questions now, please?
Absolutely. Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is off so that your signal will reach our equipment. Again, please press star 1 at this time to ask for a question, and we'll pause for one moment. And we will take our first question from Michael Grunwald with Time.
Hey, Lester. Thanks for doing
this. Hi, Michael.
How's it going?
I
was curious. You mentioned the Obama administration's fuel efficiency rules, and I'm curious how much you think some of the other things that Obama has done, particularly in the Recovery Act, in terms of promoting some of wind and solar and electric cars. I'm wondering how much you think that has to do with the changing numbers and the changing outlook.
Well, certainly the support for the development of wind and solar has been a major factor in their growth, and this is true of most new industries. They always benefit from public support. With electric cars, I think what the Obama administration has done is create an environment in which we think about electric cars, and it certainly has been supportive of developing a U.S. battery industry, because with electric cars or plug-in hybrids, the battery becomes an important part of the car. And so I think quite a few of the things that the administration has done, from fuel efficiency standards to supporting the development of clean energy sources, have all contributed to this. But at the same time, we have to recognize that, particularly with coal, that it's been the beyond coal movement, which has emerged as such a powerful movement with, as I mentioned, Sierra Club coordinating, but there are a couple of dozen national groups here, including Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, and in the health field, the American Lung Association. So it's become a rather powerful coalition, and it helps explain why they've been so successful in one, stopping new coal plants, and two, starting to close existing ones.
Is there anything further, Mr. Grunwald?
Well, actually, if I could, I was wondering if you had thoughts about, you know, the sort of future of government, sort of industrial policy, and after what happened with Solyndra. I mean, how important is that kind of thing going to be, and do you sort of worry that government support is going to dry up?
There will always be Solyndras when you're supporting new initiatives in any field. But when you look at some of the major technologies that are now in use, whether it's jet aircraft or the Internet, these were all technologies first developed by government. The jet engines, of course, part of the military R&D in World War II. And then the Internet was initially developed to facilitate communication between U.S. groups of U.S. scientists, and then sort of went from there. So government does play an important role, and there's always a question of, you know, how much and so forth. And as has been noted in the press, you know, picking winners is not a certain thing, and so there's always a risk that there's going to be a Solyndra along the way. But the bottom line is that government involvement in R&D and initial support of new technologies has always been an important part of the U.S. development process, and has been a major factor in making the U.S. The economy that it is today.
Thanks.
And moving on to Felix von Geyer with Plus Emissions Daily.
Hello, Lester. Nice to hear you again. Lester, I'm kind of interested. I just want to quickly pick up on a point that Michael made earlier about Solyndra. I think it's probably worth pointing out that there's been an awful lot of lobbying, including paying into Hillary Clinton's former presidential nomination campaign by the people behind the Keystone XL pipeline. So it's worth keeping an eye out on that when people are demonizing Solyndra and the industrial policy of the Obama administration. But the question I want to ask is, if we're looking to actually phase out more of the coal power fire stations, how are we going to do that with very sort of extensive lobbying by people like Peabod Energy, and we've got a lot of the Blue Dog Democrat senators are from coal-fired states as well. How viable is it going to be? And what do we also do if we're going to fuel switch to, say, gas-fired power stations to actually have kind of carbon capture storage on those, so we don't actually still have a greenhouse gas emissions problem?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that one of the problems the coal industry have, and it's a pretty fundamental one, is that the American people do not like coal. In a poll that was done a few years ago, 3% of Americans, when asked where they would like their electricity to come from and given the options, 3% chose coal. You can't get much lower than that. And the public image of the coal industry and the accident in West Virginia and the image that the coal industry leadership presents in the public is not a very positive one, and people are not very supportive of the industry at all, which is why we're seeing this grassroots campaign that Sierra is coordinating acquire so much firepower, if you will. They're really moving. On the carbon capture and sequestration, most of the research projects on that have been dropped or delayed or what have you. There's very little money now going into carbon capture and sequestration, which was mostly for coal. I think it was something that was kept alive in order to try to make a credible case that coal was an important part of our future. But despite all the clean coal ads, the industry is not gaining much support, and it is sufficiently isolated that I don't think lobbyists in Washington can breathe life back into the industry. And we do know that even if we had a successful carbon capture and sequestration, it would increase the cost of coal-fired power by roughly a third. And the same would be true for, I don't know the economics for carbon sequestration with natural gas, but it would mean a substantial additional cost to the cost of gas-fired electricity at a time when it's having trouble competing with wind, for example. A recent example of this is in Brazil, where they auction off electrical generating rights each year. It used to be that natural gas dominated that bidding process, but the last time around, wind took over almost entirely. In terms, I think they're adding another 6,000 megawatts, and two-thirds or four-fifths of them was won by wind bidders. So wind is becoming competitive. So too is solar. So we're in a situation where the cost of renewables has been coming down, is continuing to come down, whereas the cost of fossil fuels is tending to rise.
Is there actually any issue still going to be with the baseload argument? Because obviously having the wind means that a lot of people will say, well, it's great to have it, but you can't rely on it as baseload.
What we're seeing around the world is that's not nearly as much of a problem as one might expect initially. There are three states in northern Germany that now get between 40 and 60% of their electricity from wind. So they obviously have figured something out. In Iowa, as I mentioned, they're getting 20% of their electricity from wind. But there are a number of ways of dealing with that. One, there is a model that's been developed by a team at Stanford University looking at wind and baseload. And what they conclude is that if we develop a national grid, which we are in the process of doing, then wind actually becomes part of the baseload, because even though wind is intermittent, it's always blowing in many places. The key is a larger grid and more wind farms, and the more you get, the more stable it becomes as a source. So there are a number of ways of dealing with that, and you're probably aware of the effort that's underway now in New Mexico, near Clovis, New Mexico, which is where the three U.S. grids come together or come very close to each other, one being the eastern grid, which is east coast to the Rocky Mountains, and there's the western grid and the Texas grid. And the what they're doing now is they'll probably break ground on this either next month or in January, but it's well along. And they're going to connect the three grids with about 120 miles of HVDC, high voltage direct current cable, so we can begin moving electricity around. Now, this doesn't really give us a strong national grid by any means, but it is the first step in creating a national grid.
Thank you.
And our next question will come from Isaac Hernandez with El Mundo.
Hello, Lester. Thank you very much.
Hi, Isaac.
I'm curious about two different things, and you can answer either one of them. One is, do you see the trends in natural gas also going down in the near future, and the reduction of fracking. And the other one is, how does our oil consumption and coal consumption, has it gone down when we consider also our imports? Do you know what the trends in China are as far as coal and oil going down, and if our imports, if it's actually more drastic because it seems that maybe we are consuming less imports?
Right.
Thank you.
When you look at carbon emissions in the United States and in China, what you see are two very different trends. For some time, they were both going up, though China was going up faster. China is continuing to go up fast, whereas the United States is now declining at a pretty good rate. The decline in the U.S. in carbon emissions in the last 4 years does not quite offset the increase in carbon emissions in China. Once it becomes known that the U.S. is cutting carbon emissions and that the dip we've seen in the last few years is not just because of the economic recession, then I think it's going to affect how other countries think, and it also is going to give hope that we can actually have a meaningful international response to the threat of climate change. The other thing that I didn't mention is that with it seems like almost every week now there's a new study out talking about how climate change is leading to more extreme weather events, and these are beginning to be of concern to people. And the more concerned we become about our climate future, the more pressure there will be to move from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy. The good news in China is that they have become the world leader in developing both wind resources and in manufacturing solar cells. In wind resources, there are now 7 wind-based complexes under development in China of at least 10,000 megawatts each. To put that in perspective, there is no coal-generating complex or nuclear-generating complex in the world that comes even close to 10,000 megawatts. So these are huge. The largest of these is a wind complex being developed in Gansu province in the northwest. When it's completed, it will have 38,000 megawatts of generating capacity. That is huge. That one wind complex will produce enough electricity to satisfy the needs of a country like Poland or Egypt, for example. And these are two countries for which I've actually done the calculation. So we're seeing thinking in wind energy on a scale that we've never seen in the energy sector before. We've not seen anything on this scale with either coal or nuclear power. So these are the exciting things happening in the world that lead me to think that we do have a chance at the global level of beginning to reduce carbon emissions in the years ahead. On the natural gas, down or up, natural gas use over the last 4 years has increased by 6%, as I mentioned. DOE sees very little increase in natural gas use in the United States this year. And whether we'll get a lot of more growth in the years immediately ahead or not remains to be seen. But natural gas has to be able to compete with wind and solar, and with solar, it's peak power, which is important, and it turns out that with solar cells, the peak generation coincides very nicely in a place like California with peak power, which is determined mostly by the need for air conditioning. So solar is very good for meeting peak power needs, and it's difficult for other sources to compete with it in that area. The future of fracking is hard to say, but opposition to it is developing in more and more places. In the United States, some states like New Jersey have banned it entirely. Some countries, France, for example, have banned fracking entirely. So we'll have to see how it plays out. But the other thing is that the early estimates of the amount of natural gas that the industry was claiming were clearly fraudulent. They were trying to sell a bill of goods and build a natural gas infrastructure and so forth. But the U.S. Geological Survey, in its estimate that came out, I think it's a couple months ago now, indicates that the amount of gas available, gas reserves in the U.S., including importantly those from fracking, are probably about one-fourth of what the industry is claiming. So those are all things affecting the future prospects of natural gas.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, if you'd like to ask a question today, that's star one at this time. Again, star one to ask a question. Next, we'll move on to Randy Shostak with EOS Newspaper of the American Geophysical Union.
Thank you. Yeah, it's EOS. Can you provide me with some evidence that the decline in the use of coal is linked directly to the Beyond Coal campaign rather than due to economic downturn?
The early decline in coal consumption that began following the downturn in 2007 was almost certainly due to the economic downturn. That was true of energy, of all the fossil fuels, more or less across the board. But the important thing now is we have new sources developing. If you look at the coal plant construction pipeline, for example, it's about to run dry. If you look at the number of plants scheduled to close, some of which are, and that 68 plants scheduled to close don't include the recent closings, for example, but these are all the result of the campaign. I think the campaign is the overwhelming factor in the decline of coal in the U.S. Both the 10% decline over the last 4 years, not the only one, but the certainly the dominant one, and I think in the years ahead it's going to become almost totally dominant as more and more coal plants are forced to close. And I want to emphasize the importance of local groups here because they have a lot of clout at the local political level, and it's their health that's being affected, and it's health concerns that's a primary mobilizer of the local grassroots groups around the country that are taking on local coal-fired power plants.
And also, are you concerned that news of this, as you say, historic reversal of trends could perhaps lead to complacency in other efforts to reduce carbon emissions?
Well, because it's new, and because I think the concern about climate change is going to continue rising, I don't see right now any signs of complacency, partly because I don't think most people have yet realized that this is not just this decline in carbon emissions the last 4 years is not just part of the economic downturn. And is really being driven by some entirely new but very powerful trends.
Thank you.
The other thing is that I think concern about climate change is going to be mounting. I've noticed during this year that beginning in late March and early April when the tornado season began, and then was followed by drought and wildfires in Texas and a record heat, the hottest year in history in Texas and the driest year in history as that was unfolding. And then we had record flooding in many places in the Mississippi Valley. And then as we moved on, we had Hurricane Irene and then we had Tropical Storm Lee, I think it was. And what I realized was that during that period from late March up into early September, the news channels had become weather channels. It was not unusual for the networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, to spend more than half of their evening program on hurricane effects or Irene or what have you. And so I think that indicates... That is an indicator the news channels in effect becoming weather channels is an indication of a level of concern that people have with what's happening with the weather, which to some degree is being driven by long-term changes in the Earth's climate.
Thank you.
And next we'll hear from Arthur Max with the Associated Press.
Yeah, when President Obama came to Copenhagen 2009, the Copenhagen Climate Conference, he pledged that the United States would cut carbon emissions by 17% by 2020, and this was met, I'm afraid, with some derision by many of the participants in the climate conference. And so I'm wondering if, and I think that 17% pledge was based on many of the trends that you have identified. So I'm wondering if you think that that the Obama administration can go any farther, whether there's going to be any change in position, in the negotiating position by the United States. And I wonder if I can just refer to the answer to the last question, the political climate in the United States, given what you call the growing concern about climate change in the U.S. Public, why is this so much of a taboo subject in the political debate today?
One of the things that's been very successful in recent years has been the climate disinformation campaign. Almost every time, and it's really modeled after the tobacco industry campaign of a couple of decades ago, where every time a scientist came out with a study that would link smoking with some health problem, someone hired by the tobacco industry, usually one of their scientists, would challenge the methodology in the study and therefore the credibility of the study. But there was this consistent effort to undermine the credibility of the medical science that underpinned the effects of cigarette smoking on health. No one ever raises that question anymore. I mean, suddenly we reached a tipping point on it when everyone knew that there was a relationship between smoking and health. And I think we're moving toward the same thing on the climate front, though you wouldn't gather it, and you certainly wouldn't expect it from listening to the political candidates or some of the other things that are happening. But I think we're clearly close to a tipping point on this issue. And incidentally, the networks would not be carrying all the coverage of these extreme weather events if they didn't think people wanted to see them. There is an interest level in what's happening with weather, and it's beginning to translate into knowledge of and concern about the longer-term role of climate change in shaping these more extreme weather events. As you may know, there was a paper released, I think, just yesterday from the IPCC dealing with this. Coming back to the 17% by 2020, I don't think those who were working on that proposal saw that as something that was going to happen independently of an international agreement at Copenhagen. I think the feeling was that this would take a very substantial effort. In fact, the congressional opposition was based on the idea that this would be a huge sacrifice in a country where carbon emissions rise, and that rise has been associated over the generations with an improvement in the quality of life. And the idea that carbon emissions could be coming down or would be going down as much as they have, I do not think was part of the thinking of those who were formulating that proposal.
Mr. Max, is there anything further, sir?
No, thank you. Yeah, that was great.
And moving on to Pat Reber with Deutsche Press Agentur.
Hi, Pat.
Hi, Lester. How you doing?
Good.
I wanted to follow up on the question from my colleague about the climate summit in Durban. And I don't quite understand your previous answer, so it's a twofold question that I'll have for you. Where do you see things going next year when Kyoto expires? What do you think? What do you expect to happen in Durban? What do you think will happen?
I concluded some years ago that internationally negotiated climate agreements were not going to be the solution to the climate problem. And what's happened since then has certainly borne out that that expectation. When you think about the delegations that go to these conferences, they are mostly diplomats and lawyers. And when was the last time you saw a large group of diplomats and lawyers come up with a bold new idea? I don't think it's going to happen. You know, if countries sent their climate scientists, their environmental leaders to a conference who tried not to see who could do the least to cut carbon emissions, but who could do the most, then we would have a very different climate. But I don't think this model is a viable one anymore. And when you look around the world at the things that are happening in terms of carbon emission reductions, it's not being driven by international agreements. It's being driven by this Sierra Club, by grassroots movements, and it's being driven also by concern about climate change that's not tied to any agreements, but just looking at the effect in China of what happens to their food production when the glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau, whose ice melt helps sustain the Yellow and the Yangtze rivers, disappear, which is now a distinct possibility. And then realizing that the ice melt that sustains those rivers and the irrigation systems dependent on them may not be there someday is a wake-up call, and you don't have to draw pictures for the Chinese, for them to see this. So I think it's that kind of thing that's going to drive the change. And we're seeing governments. We're seeing the Danish government, the new government, committing to cutting carbon emissions 40% by 2020. We've seen David Cameron in the UK pledge the UK government to a 50% cut by 2025. And this had nothing to do with Copenhagen or Durban or what have you. This had to do with what they thought their country should be doing in order to deal with the climate issue.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I'd like to follow up on that then. When you mentioned this pledge to cut by 70% by 2020 on the part of the U.S., are you saying you didn't think that was an honest offer, or that the people that the government, that the administration that offered that cut didn't seriously think that it would ever happen? Is that what you said?
Yeah. I think if you'd put that before Congress, you would have gone nowhere. Which you have to do with an international agreement at some place. So I think this strategy the Obama administration was to offer something that would be, at least would appear to be meaningful. And I think at that time it was thought that 17% was meaningful, and that mm-hmm. it would take it would be really tough to do that. But in fact, I think we're going to do that, and probably more without any international agreement to drive the process, because I don't think people are motivated very much by international agreements, and they're motivated by market prices, like for oil, or for the health of their families, as with coal. We know about the 13,200 deaths due to coal, but the number of people who suffer from respiratory illnesses is in this country from as a result of pollutants from coal-fired plants is huge, and that's true in many other parts of the world as well. So I think it's responding to these things. It's really, really driving our response to the need for climate change.
Okay. Thank you, Lester.
And moving on to Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock.
Lester, I'm wondering how much of the coal figures that you presented, actually the oil figures you presented, the reduction, are the result of two factors offshoring them, one being the offshoring of production to China. Their emissions are rising, and it's partly because everything is made there. And secondly, also, do these figures take into account the excess pollution from the Canadian tar sands, which even without this pipeline are powering a large part of the Midwest? So there's so much emissions in Canada that may not be showing up in the American figures.
Alex, those are both good points. Because we import so many manufactured goods from China, the carbon emissions that are associated with our consumption actually show up in China's carbon emission. That's not a debatable point. And it's true that the numbers I'm talking about do not include those. And it's also the case that emissions associated with the Canadian tar sands in getting the oil out of the sand show up in Canada's carbon emissions and not ours. So those are two things that would, if we had an accounting system that was based on consumption rather than the production side, we would see a somewhat different world, and China's carbon emissions would not be nearly as large as they are in other countries that, such as the U.S., would be higher than they are. But even given that, the trend of the last 4 years and the trend that we see for the next several years are based on a constant in terms of our relationship with China and with Canada.
And moving on to Dan Coffey with San Diego Daily Transcript.
Hello, Mr. Brown. My question, I have many questions, of course, but I've been concerned for some time about the timing of deployment of wind and solar as being too late to really intercede where you have a kind of front-loading with CO2 into the atmosphere, which will take us past some critical tipping point so that we can't do anything effective with respect to the amount of destruction that you're actually going to see from climate change, weather, drought, et cetera, all these kinds of things. And I'm curious if you share that concern and what should be done with respect to opposition groups. Here in California, we have a lot of environmental opposition to wind farms and to large-scale solar, and that concerns me because it seems counterintuitive to what you would typically think environmental groups would be trying to do.
Right. One of the weaknesses of the environmental movement is that a lot of the groups are local groups, so they focus on the local situation. And they sort of lose sight of the bigger picture in terms of the their local interests, and that's the case for opposing wind farms in some parts of the country. It's the case for solar farms in parts of Southern California, I wish it were not that way, and that we would always be looking at the big picture and making decisions, but it turns out not to be the case. One of the other side of that coin is that with wind power, for example, there is enormous competition for wind farms among ranching communities in the Great Plains and farming communities in the Midwest, even upper New York State, for example. And the reason for that is because farmers and ranchers can continue to use their land. A farmer in Iowa can can continue growing corn even if he sells the wind rights, because the turbines only occupy 1% of the land area, so the other 99% can be farmed or grazed or what have you. So for farmers and ranchers, it enables them to double crop and have two sources of income. And sometimes the wind royalties will generate more income than cattle sales. So while the media focuses on the negative responses, there are a lot of strong supporters within communities for these new sources of energy.
One quick follow-up. I've read some of Jim Hansen's recent work, especially some of his drafts, and he talks about the fact that if we were to stop all production of CO2 into the atmosphere now, that it would take till 2050 to return to 350 parts per million CO2. But if we go another 20 years, it'll be an additional 250 years before we naturally return to 350 parts per million. And that concerns me a great deal, in the sense that the energy integrand of accumulated energy into the environment is going to be extremely large over the next 20 years, and that would seem to suggest that we should do everything today we possibly can to reduce CO2 as much as possible, instead of doing it over a kind of gradated schedule. And I'm curious what your thought is on that.
In our recent books here, we have something we call Plan B, and it is our judgment that if you start with the science and start formulating goals for cutting carbon emissions, we think we, you know, if we want to save, have a decent chance of saving, say, the Greenland ice sheet, and I use that as kind of a metaphor, because if we can't save that, then we probably can't save civilization, you know, if we get a 23-foot rise in sea level. And so we're, if you were to ask me what I think we should be doing, this 20% by 2020 that looks like we'll be getting the way things are now going, we think we should cut carbon emissions 80% by 2020 to try to get ahead of the to get ahead of things and to at least have a decent chance, a decent shot at saving the Greenland ice sheet. So I quite agree with you, and my hope is that a year or two from now we'll have another press teleconference like this, and I'll talk about why the 20% was conservative, and we're going to be doing even more than that by 2020. Things are changing, but they're not yet changing fast enough.
One last thing. Are you encouraging environmental groups, especially like Sierra Club that has local groups that are opposing wind farms, to just really see the big picture and the, you know, concern over habitat? Are you personally doing that?
I am not personally doing that. I say that, and when I'm in touch with leaders in the environmental community, it's not just Sierra, but it could be Audubon, it could be National Wildlife Federation. Any of the large groups have local interests that are not always in sync with the larger interests. I have not made a personal campaign of it, but I do mention it, and I am concerned about it.
Thank you very much.
You know, Jen, we probably should, or Cynthia, we probably should wrap this up with one more question, because folks are probably getting tired of listening at this point.
And it appears there are no further questions in the queue at this time. Mr. Brown, I would like to turn the conference back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
I just want to thank everyone who was participating today. I think this is an historic new trend that we're seeing, with this reversal in carbon emissions in the U.S. that will affect, will have not only economic consequences for world energy sector restructuring, but also is the bottom line issue on trying to stabilize climate.
And this does conclude our conference call for today. We'd like to thank you for your participation.